This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers' Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Behind the environmental crisis and everything that you've heard about human impact on the planet, there's another crisis that you don't hear much about at all, because even the word is practically taboo at this point: overpopulation. We're pushing toward 8 billion people on the planet. Hardly any government wants to do anything about it, and certainly not ours. That may be largely because of the example set by China historically. China did do something about overpopulation, something drastic and ultimately brutal. From the 1970s until 2015, China put into effect the one-child policy, and the consequences of that policy will be felt for generations. Nanfu Wang is a filmmaker, and her documentary, One Child Nation, looks at the toll that policy took on her family. She talked with Jiang Fan, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker.
Can you briefly explain why you chose to make a film about the one-child policy?
So China's one-child policy started in 1979 and ended at the end of 2015. I was born in 1985, 6 years after the one-child policy started. My co-director, Jialin, was born in 1983 or 84, I believe. And we both grew up under the policy. And for me, I became a mother 2 years ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And being pregnant and having my first child really made me question a lot of the things that I never thought about. I just couldn't imagine how millions of women lived under the fear of not knowing whether they could protect the child that they were pregnant with. And I started asking my mom what it was like for her generation when they had to be sterilized by the government. And what she told me made me realize that I really didn't know the one-child policy at all.
I am a product of the one-child policy. I was born in Chongqing and moved here at the age of 7. And what I remember of that experience was the posters of two parents and one child plastered on every available surface and also in all textbooks. And of course, I was too young to question that a family could be defined by anything other than a mother, a father, and a child. For you, who stayed in China past your adolescence and spent your young adulthood there, was there questioning or interrogating why it is that families have to be policed in this way? Was there at all, what was that process of questioning like, if there was a process before coming to the U.S.?
I don't think I had questioned the one-child policy to that extent when I was in China. The message was everywhere. Everywhere you could see, it was like a tree standing there. It's a wall building there. It's like a building that you go to school and you pass by every day. So at some point, you just stop paying attention to it. You assume that it's a normal part of existence of the universe. And you don't know that it's something that is initiated and implemented by the authority by a visible hand you assume is the background of your life, is a normal part of everything, just like water is air existed there.
I wish I could say something to my mom. Like most people in China, she believes the policy was necessary for China's survival. But I wondered if people like her really thought it was worth the sacrifices each family made.
What I found really poignant about the documentary was the number of your family members that featured in it. And I wondered what that process was like asking your mother and brother and grandfather and aunts and uncles to be involved. How much convincing did it take you?
All of them, to a certain extent, was reluctant to for different reasons. My grandpa, I told him I wanted to record your whole life story on camera as a record, so my son, your great grandson, grew up, he could understand and know you, like, in a way. And so I actually talked to him for like over 5 hours, and literally like from the moment he was born to now. And my brother was shy. He didn't want to be on camera, and he did it for me. And I think my mom also did it because I was her daughter. She would do anything I asked her. And my uncle was really hard for me to request the interview because I knew how painful it would be for him to tell the story about the daughter that he gave away, he left to die.
Right. I mean, that was one of the most gut-wrenching moments in the film, I think. You know, your uncle just in brief, you know, describes this experience of being, you know, forced to let his, you know, firstborn, a girl, die because the family just wanted a boy so badly. Can you take us through kind of what happened after your uncle abandoned his daughter at the market and how that story lived in the family?
I think I was old enough. I was a child. I don't remember how many years I was, like 6 or something, when my mom actually helped my uncle to take the baby to the market. And only until now I was making the film and asked my mom. And my mom, of course, told the story in a much more vivid way. And then when I approached my uncle, and he told me the story from his first-person perspective, which was he stood there across the street, watched to see if somebody would come and take the baby, and watched the baby cry and wanted to bring her home. But then his mom threatened to commit suicide, and he couldn't do that. And he felt so torn. There was no right decision. Like, he believed that his mom was going to commit suicide, which we all believed.
I told my mother about that moment in the film immediately after watching it because it haunted me so much. Because I think your uncle's description of the mosquito bites that plagued the little girl as she was left in the market was so incredibly vivid. And I felt this strange guilt of being alive because it was just by sheer luck that I, also in China, was born and got to be kept. And there is this element of just a very cruel lottery at work where who determines who dies and who lives seems, you know, very, very random. And you know, your name is Nanfu, and Nan, I know, is the character for man or boy. And for me, too, my name is Jiayang, which it's more of a boy's name than a girl's. And it was born out of my parents' desire that I would be a boy. And in a way, I have this very strange relationship with my name where I'm perversely proud of it because I think, well, you know, I made it, you know, the fated boy did not, and I'm here to stay. And I always, in China, am addressed, you know, on emails as Mr. Fan, you know. But I was wondering what your relationship with your name has been.
Nan means man and Fu means pillar. Mm-hmm. Pillar of the family, pillar of the country. And when I was a child, they've told me that they gave me the name and they hope that even though I was a girl, that I could be like a man and be the pillar of the family. And when my father passed away and I was 12, it became something that I felt it was his hope for me. And it's something that he left for me. So weirdly enough, like you said, I also felt proud of my name.
Right.
In a way that, like, I would often, like, have that kind of conversation with my dad after he died. I was like, look, Dad, I made it. Like, I am stronger than men now.
Right.
Yeah.
So toward the end of the documentary, you mentioned the irony in the fact that you left a country that enforced abortions to go to a country, the U.S., that restricts and debates the right to abortion. Can you talk a little bit about this this irony?
Yeah. Restriction of reproductive rights is not unique to China. And we really wanted people who are outside of China to see the film and to really reflect on their own society, to look at where the propaganda is and whether they have mistaken propaganda as the truth on what women should or should not do with their own body, should be their own choice. And I think in America, where I now live, I would have assumed that in a country where respect of freedom and the respect of rights would have recognized the reproductive rights for women as the basic rights, but it wasn't that case. And to me, that was just really sad and shocking to see.
In 2015, we got the news that the party ended the one-child policy. What is your kind of idea of China's family planning model today? And are you optimistic that this society will, you know, encourage more, you know, freedoms?
I really wanted to be optimistic. But I don't think that I am optimistic, especially over the past 3 or 4 years. I've seen how the society got tightened up even more, how the VPNs are being cracked down, and how more and more activists were arrested, and how the civil society is even more closed than before.
So the answer is a resounding no.
Yeah, and we now have a president who has a, like, unlimited term.
Yes. We now have an emperor in effect.
So
has your mom and brother watched the film, and has it done anything to change their perspective?
My mom and my brother were both at the premiere at Sundance in January. It was the first time they ever came to, like, a screening of my films. My mom, her entire life in the village, she's never been to a movie theater.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So my mom watched it, and then she said, it was so true what you showed in the film. It was exactly like what I saw, and it's, what I saw is even worse. I've seen way worse than this. But I still think the policy was necessary. So she was really, I think it really struck me how effective the propaganda was.
Will this documentary be screened ever in China? Is it allowed to be screened in China?
It has been shown in Hong Kong. It will be shown in Taiwan. And we also have a screening in a lot of, like, Mandarin-speaking, Chinese-speaking areas. And in China, some independent film festivals have reached out and wanted to show underground screenings. And if the country would ever change, the first step would be the awareness for people to know what happened. Then once their awareness start to change, that's when their action would be changed too.
Filmmaker Nan Fu Wong, whose documentary One Child Nation is in the theaters now. She spoke with The New Yorker's Jiayong Fan. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for today. Thanks for being with us, and if you've enjoyed the show, I just want to remind you, you can subscribe to the podcast and catch up on anything you missed. See you next time.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.